Tuesday, June 11, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Just a few weeks ago, Dr. Kermit Gosnell was found guilty of several counts of first-degree murder in the case of the so-called House of Horrors abortion clinic in Philadelphia. Gosnell eventually decided to forfeit all right to appeal his conviction in hopes of avoiding the death penalty. Americans responded in indignation, in righteous outrage over the House of Horrors there in Philadelphia, where a woman died during an abortion and where several babies born alive were murdered by the doctor by using a pair of scissors on the baby's spinal column. The House of Horrors abortion clinic became notorious across the country and even internationally, but those who were behind the abortion rights industry insisted that it was an outlier, that this was a very tragic case, but an exceptional case. We're about to find out if that's true, and we're also about to find out if Americans, in expressing righteous indignation about Kermit Gosnell, were serious about their opposition to this kind of House of Horrors. Why? Because there are other abortion clinics just like that House of Horrors in Philadelphia, and now it appears that one of them could be very well right here in Houston, the city from which I'm speaking today. As reporter Mike Tolson of the Houston Chronicle reports, in the never-ending war over legal abortion, the front lines don't stay front for long. Case in point, Philadelphia abortionist Kermit Gosnell, who dominated the anti-abortion airwaves during his murder trial, then quickly was supplanted by a Houston doctor following Gosnell's conviction last month. The prison cell had barely slammed shut on Gosnell when abortion foes directed attention to Douglas Carpin, who they claim operates a similar House of Horrors in Houston. Reading further into Tolson's report, he says Carpin's legal history includes a half dozen medical malpractice and negligence lawsuits arising from his work at the clinics. These suits, which were reviewed by the paper, include troubling allegations of a woman's death caused by a botched abortion, as well as allegations of a late-term procedure that went awry, with the baby being born and living for 6 months before dying. There can be no doubt that Dr. Carpin has performed late-term abortions. One of them, at least, is alleged on a 15-year-old girl who supposedly lied about her age. The doctor is also charged with routinely falsifying ultrasound evidence in order to falsify the actual fetal age of a baby, allowing for an abortion weeks or months after it would have been illegal. There have been numerous lawsuits filed against this doctor, and even other abortion facilities tend to want to keep their distance from Dr. Carpin. Even as Texas health authorities have launched an investigation, and criminal investigations are also pending, advocates of the abortion rights industry have been defenders of Dr. Carpin, suggesting that the accusations made against him amount to nothing more than pro-life harassment. In other words, it appears that at least some people in the aftermath of the Kermit Gosnell trial have learned absolutely nothing, not even enough to improve their public relations efforts. Tolson reports that whether Carpin or other doctors employed by his clinics broke the law will not be known until investigations are completed. This will be a case that will bear a close watch. It is indicative of the fact that the so-called House of Horrors in Philadelphia was never solitary. It was never the outlier that the pro-abortionist claimed that it was. And now we have evidence not only in the case of Dr. Carpin in Houston, but in others around the country, with one state shutting down several abortion clinics on similar charges just recently, that these are not really outlier clinics. They are indicative in a very tragic way of the nature of the abortion clinic itself. But that gets to a problem of logic and of perception on the pro-life side. Sometimes when something like this occurs, pro-lifers understand that this presents a graphic picture of the ugliness of abortion. But we must be very careful, because if we follow a consistent pro-life ethic, we believe that every single child that is conceived is a child that deserves to be born. In other words, we think that the whole idea of a so-called safe abortion clinic is an oxymoron of tragic and evil construction. What takes place in every abortion clinic, even not those that the press and the media would identify as a house of horrors, is a house of horrors for the unborn child. Every single abortion clinic, no matter how clean the facility or well-trained its personnel, is a house of horrors for the unborn. The very character of the clinic, an abortion clinic, is to exist in order to terminate the lives of unborn children. In other words, even as the pro-abortion industry is doing its very best to confuse the issue about abortion clinics, sometimes pro-lifers can fall into the very same pattern. Every abortion clinic is a house of horrors. not just the ones that demonstrate with a particular ugly honesty what actually an abortion clinic is all about. We've often discussed the fact that it would be possible, in a sense, to create something like a moral map of America. It wouldn't be a simple map because we'd have to have different maps for different issues. But the point is certainly made and affirmed over and over again that there is a moral and cultural divide in this country that is at least partially geographic, identifiable almost state by state. That was true before the U.S. Supreme Court ordered abortion on demand coast to coast when several states had legal abortion in 1973. The majority did not, and you could group them roughly geographically, with the states on the two coasts, and especially on the West Coast and on the Atlantic Northeast, most likely to have legal abortion. The great heartland of the country was quite different, with almost no state prior to Roe v. Wade having anything like abortion on demand as a legal right. We've been watching in recent years as at least 28 states have taken very distinct action in order to strengthen the legal rights of the fetus. Incrementally, they have chipped away at abortion on demand. Those 28 states have pointed the way towards the more general moral trajectory with an increased percentage of Americans holding pro-life sentiments. But now, even as there have been several states in the news for increased legislative action in terms of the pro-life cause, a very different direction is now apparent in the state of New York, where Governor Andrew Cuomo seems absolutely determined to protect late-term abortions, a so-called woman's right to a late-term abortion, in terms of the laws of that state. As the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life reports, Governor Cuomo has proposed a bill that would essentially codify Roe v. Wade in state law, meaning that abortions would be allowed up to 24 weeks or later if a woman's health, including her emotional health, is in danger or if the fetus she is carrying is not expected to survive after birth. Even though Roe and other court decisions already give women in New York access to these types of late-term abortions, an official in the Cuomo administration contends that the proposal is necessary in case Roe is one day overturned or narrowed by the Supreme Court. In becoming such a strong advocate for abortion rights, Governor Andrew Cuomo seems to be following in the footsteps of his father, former New York Governor Mario Cuomo, who made his mark on the abortion issue by giving a speech at the University of Notre Dame. Cuomo, a practicing Catholic, went to the Catholic-identified university and declared that he, as a Catholic, was opposed to abortion on moral grounds. But as a legislator and a politician, he was required by his constitutional responsibilities to defend abortion rights. That was one of those arguments that then began to clarify the distinctions between very liberal Catholic positions and more traditional Catholic positions in terms of moral responsibility in public life. At the end of the day, there's very little that is distinctive about a Roman Catholic politician if he forfeits all Roman Catholic teaching in order to defend abortion rights. The same thing is true for evangelicals, of course, as there are many evangelicals who claim membership in an evangelical church, but then turn and forfeit those convictions on the altar of political expediency. But the interesting thing about the two Cuomos is that Mario Cuomo, perhaps reflecting an older generation of liberal Catholics, at least gave lip service to the understanding that abortion is a moral tragedy. He spoke of abortion much like former President Bill Clinton, suggesting that it should be safe, legal, and rare. We've contrasted that position with that of many modern Democratic politicians, including President Obama, who never speak of abortion as a moral tragedy and never speak of abortion being rare. Instead, they speak of abortion in unabashed enthusiasm without any suggestion that there should be any restriction on abortion whatsoever or that any reason or no reason at all should constitute an insufficient basis for a woman seeking an abortion. Andrew Cuomo now follows in that very modern Democratic trajectory, one very much in keeping with the 2012 Democratic National Convention's platform, and what we see in his recent legislative proposals in Albany, New York, is an attempt to protect late-term abortions even past the point when a baby would be viable outside the womb. This is a moral extremism that even most Democrats across the country would not support, but this is New York State, And once again, geography matters, and it matters where you are conceived as a baby in terms of the likelihood that you will have an abortion because your mother has the so-called right even to seek a late-term abortion. One other thing to note in terms of the Cuomo proposal is that he has explicitly included the mental health of the mother as one of the key issues. As Americans learned in the aftermath of Roe v. Wade, that inclusion of mental health as a cause for an abortion gave an open door to virtually any abortion for any reason, as any woman could then claim that her inability to get an abortion would have an adverse impact on her mental health. You won't be surprised to know that in yesterday's edition of the New York Times, the editorial board of that liberal newspaper called upon legislators in Albany to get with the program and to approve Governor Cuomo's sweeping legislation, including the abortion provisions. As the editors write, the Senate's Republican leader, Dean Skelos, says he will not allow the abortion section of the bill to come to the floor, even though some Republican senators would almost certainly support it. And Jeffrey Klein, the Democrat, who shares the leadership of the Senate, has insisted that while he supports abortion rights, he also could carve out that section before a floor vote. In other words, even the pro-abortionists who are in the New York legislature, in particular in the Senate, aren't pro-abortion enough for the editorial writers of the New York Times. They conclude, the full bill deserves the support of every lawmaker who is ready to do more than talk about equal rights and increased protections for women. Once again, increased protections for women are cited, but what is really meant is decreased protection for the baby. Seminole County, Florida is about to become ground zero in another one of America's very sensational criminal trials. This one's unavoidable. On trial in Florida beginning this week is George Zimmerman, charged with killing 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. The incident happened 2 years ago and became a matter of international controversy. Trayvon Martin, the 17-year-old, was killed, and now George Zimmerman is being charged with the crime of second-degree murder. The case is going to be very difficult for any jury to decide. There will be six jurists who sit on this jury panel, and right now in Florida, it is jury selection that is currently being undertaken by the court. But this is going to be a very difficult trial. The charge being brought by state prosecutors is second-degree murder. What many people believe is that, given Florida law and the fact that George Zimmerman is the only living witness to the crime, many people believe that George Zimmerman is going to be able to use some form of a self-defense argument in order, perhaps, to lead the jury to believe that he is not guilty of any actual criminal intent against Trayvon Martin. But Trayvon Martin is dead. He is unable to speak for himself. And prosecutors in Florida are doing their very best to get a conviction against George Zimmerman, believing that if they fail to do so, it will basically open the door for a kind of vigilante justice in that state that might be grounded upon its so-called stand your ground self-defense law. The most troubling part of this criminal trial is that the issue of race is impossible to avoid. Trayvon Martin was black. George Martin is not. And what we have here is the case of a young man, a 17-year-old boy, who is dead almost assuredly because Mr. Zimmerman assumed that in some sense he was a threat. Of course, it's a very complicated story. Prosecutors are going to charge that George Zimmerman, who called 911 and was on the phone with a police dispatcher, disregarded, indeed disobeyed and contradicted, direct orders given him by the police not to try to follow Trayvon Martin. Many jurists and legal authorities watching this trial believe that there are several very sensitive issues. The first is the seating of a jury. Almost everyone who might be a candidate to be seated on this jury certainly knows a great deal about this very sensational incident. The second issue has to do with the judge's decision about what kind of evidence will and will not be considered admissible, both by prosecutors and by George Zimmerman's defense attorneys. But at the end of the day, the issue of the actual charge might also become very crucial. The law of evidence in Florida for bringing a prosecution for second-degree murder requires more than many people believe the prosecutors may be able to deliver, given the rules of evidence and the lack of any eyewitness to this incident other than George Zimmerman. But that's where many legal analysts believe that a jury, faced with contradictory evidence and the inability to know exactly what happened, might be tempted to resort to something like manslaughter as a conviction rather than second-degree murder. The prosecutors in Florida have accused Mr. Zimmerman not only of second-degree murder, but also of other lesser crimes, including manslaughter, evidently with the recognition that at the end of the day, the justice system might not be able to deliver the justice of second-degree murder, but rather something that is a lesser charge. There will be people who will be torn on both sides of this issue. This will be a contested controversy and closely watched not only by those who live in Stanford, Florida, but by many people all around the world, which means that it's not only George Zimmerman who is on trial in this case, but the American legal system. We have to hope that the American legal system, one of the most fair and just in the world, indeed in human history, can deliver on this particular trial when it comes to the human desire, the very righteous desire, the inevitable desire to try to do our very best to achieve justice, even in a fallen world. Here's a report that tells you a great deal about Americans, how we live, and how we think. This is a story with worldview implications, but implications that most people reading the story will be unlikely to see. Greg Taupo, reporting for USA Today, tells us that there are two contradictory trends when it comes to family size and house size in America. He writes, America's families may be shrinking, but our houses never got the memo. They're moving in the opposite direction. Fresh Census Bureau data show that the size of new homes keeps rising, even as Americans over the past two generations have had fewer children. At 2,306 square feet, the typical new home is about 50% larger than its counterpart in 1973, while the typical family is considerably smaller, and the typical household is a full 15% smaller. Going back to the 1950s and the 1960s, American families, often with three, four, and five children, survived in homes of only two bedrooms, sometimes another room converted into a third bedroom. But now, according to the Census Bureau, Americans with no children want three or four bedroom houses, and the houses themselves are larger, the bedrooms are larger, and amenities such as the number of bathrooms, these too have grown considerably in terms of the expectations that Americans have for their homes. You hear many people saying that they can't stay in this home because it's too small for the number of children they have. And yet, from an historical perspective, Americans have never lived in homes so large. And evidently, even as our families are actually getting smaller, our houses not only aren't getting the memo, as USA Today reports, they're getting larger and larger. Building specialists tell us that the trend toward downsizing that marked much of the last 20 years, especially among older Americans, has now been reversed. Even retired couples, it seems, want large houses with multiple bedrooms and lots of room and several bathrooms. America, in the short period of one generation, has been transformed from a country of big families and small houses to small families and big houses. Ponder that one. Finally, speaking of changes in the way we live, the Wall Street Journal reports that if you're an envelope manufacturer, your days are probably numbered. They report that the holding company for the closely held National Envelope Company was preparing over the weekend for a potential bankruptcy filing. Why? In the age of email, Americans don't use envelopes anymore. As the Journal reports, the envelope business is just one of many, from newspapers to books to yellow page directories, that have had to adjust as the internet upends habits. Email and online bill payments are some of the methods that have rendered envelopes unnecessary. The days may be numbered when Americans recognize the phrase, the envelope, please. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Houston, Texas, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.